Good evening. Hi, everybody. Hi, you can hear me? I'm Deborah Margolis. I'm the librarian who works with the Muslim Studies program here at MSU, and we're so glad you are here tonight. A special welcome for those who are coming because it's part of the Comics Forum, or because, yes, thumbs up, or because that the book that we're reading tonight is a comic book. So welcome, welcome. So the Comics Forum is a whole conference that's open to the public, and there's a keynote this Friday night, and then on Saturday there's another keynote and panels and something called Artist's Alley. Who's been to that before? Artist's Alley. What is that, Ronti? Yeah, so you can meet the comic artists and buy their work if you want, or just talk to them. So it's a lot of fun, and I think that's all free and open to the public. So that's this weekend, and also there's a exhibit of underground comics that's in the Residential College of Arts and Humanities. That's where the whole Comics Forum is, in the gallery there. That's a exhibit from our MSU Library Special Collections. So thanks to Ryan Clater of the Comics Forum for working with us at the MSU Muslim Studies Program and the MSU Libraries for a number of years now, maybe four or so. And thank you to the Muslim Studies Program and to the MSU Libraries for sponsoring these events. So in last year's Muslim Journeys Book Club, we read The Butterfly Mosque by G. Willow Wilson, which is her memoir. And tonight we're going to be discussing her comics, Ms. Marvel. The next book club is going to be 3 weeks from tonight on March 15th, and we're going to be reading a book entitled Emails from Scheherazade, which is a book of poetry, and it's by Syrian-American poet Moja Kaf. And if you haven't, I don't usually do this, but, I looked her up on YouTube and heard her recite some of her poetry, and it's going to be really fun. So I encourage you to do that, too. So what we're doing tonight, this is how it works. We're going to have about a half hour of lecture, and then we're going to break into discussion groups at these tables back here. And tonight we're also going to have one discussion room in the conference room that's just outside this room, because some people, including myself, have found it hard to hear when there's a lot of conversations, concurrent conversations going on in this room. So I'm going to see, if you'd like to be in that side room, please go that way and we can show you where it is. And we may actually ask a few people to go to that room so that we can have a group in that room. Okay. And thank you, though, to our graduate students and to one of our librarians who's going to be leading those discussion sessions. We've got Allison from History, Adrian from History, there they are, yay. Jessica from English, and a new Jessica Ackberger. Yes, I know, another Jessica. She is our new African Studies librarian at the MSU Library, so we're really happy that she's filling in tonight. And the discussion portion lasts about 45 minutes, and then we reconvene here, so come back here, and then we'll be able to ask questions or share some insights from our discussion groups. Okay? Now I'm going to introduce tonight's lecturer. So Morgan Shipley is visiting assistant professor and academic advisor in the Department of Religious Studies here at MSU. His research focuses on new religious movements, religious pluralism, and non-Christian religiosity in America, specifically through analyses of popular culture, social movements, political practices, and identity structures. Dr. Shipley is co-editor of The Science of Fallout, Nuclear Criticism in a Post-Cold War World, and the author of Psychedelic Mysticism, Transforming Consciousness, Religious Experiences, and Voluntary
Peasants?
Yep. In Post-War America. And those were just published in the past few years. And he's written on a variety of topics in peer-reviewed journals and anthologies and encyclopedias, and he just finalized an article that explores Muslim American popular culture and the limitations of pluralism in contemporary America. So welcome, Morgan. The Dr. Shipley.
No,
Morgan is good. That's how I tell my students to talk to me. I do talk a little fast. I get excited when I present and talk about issues. So if I'm going too fast, somebody just make a hand signal for me to slow down. My family's also been very sick, and I've been the healthy one, but I have caught a head cold. And so my voice also can go in and out. So hopefully I'll have enough to get through this today. So thank you all for coming out. I'm really excited. Deb just said, I just finished an article that really centers on Ms. Marvel in relation to the novel The Taqwa Corps by Michael Muhammad Knight. And so I feel very privileged to have this opportunity to present this to you and kind of find a way to maybe situate the value of reading Ms. Marvel in the context of our current contemporary moment. So I'm not actually going to talk a ton about Ms. Marvel until the very end of this presentation. Rather, I want to provide a context to think about how popular culture has both represented, in very problematic ways, Islam and Arabic culture and others that don't quite exist within the Christian milieu of America, but also how popular culture has emerged, especially in the last 10 years, as a device to push back against these types of stereotypes and tropes. So oftentimes, when we think about public discourse, and very specifically about popular culture, we often are given very singular, monolithic representations of religion. And this is especially true of non-Christian religions. We're often presented with just Judaism and Hinduism and Buddhism as if these are just singular religious perspectives, that there's no diversity to them, that there's not Judaisms, that there's not different inflections of Hinduism, and there's not different ways to practice Buddhism. It's this very monolithic identity. That could probably not be more true than when we think about Islam and Muslims. They are presented in an exceedingly monolithic way that often conflates together Muslims and Arabic culture. On the one hand, we ignore the fact that there's non-Muslims living in Arabic countries. And this conflation together is really a device that has emerged in American imaginary that goes all the way back to when Thomas Edison creates the very first motion picture called Fatima Dances. And he uses the image of a belly dancer to represent kind of this exotic other that we can put into mediated world. So for the last 100 plus years, we've been dealing with a singular representation that presents Muslims and Arabic culture as set against the West, and very specifically set against liberal culture. And so when we do consume media, and often the problem with this is that most of us come to a sense of religious literacy. We come to learn about religions that aren't our own by consuming media. The problem becomes when we get representations like this. Right? And this is kind of a wide swath that looks at TV, that looks at films, that looks at children's comics, that also looks at contemporary magazines. And it becomes pretty straightforward. There's not much that you can get beyond other than the gross generalizations and misrepresentations of thinking about the way in which specifically often Muslim men are turned into these kind of monstrous figures, the monster that we must be scared of. On the next slide, I'll show you the actual Fatima dances, but this really begins in earnest with Rudolph Valentino's The Sheik, that takes an Anglo version, right, of a person of Arabic descent, connects everything kind of evil and bad to Arabic people specifically and Muslims more generally, and makes this figure who is Anglicized into kind of the hero. And that becomes a common trope. So for example, up in Aladdin, which these are still frames from, the only character to be modeled off of a non-gross misrepresentation is Aladdin himself, who's actually represented, or is actually based off of Tom Cruise. Right? And in terms of the film itself, there's two voices that are given kind of Anglo voices, and that's Jasmine and Aladdin. Everyone else is given this very kind of grotesque version of what this other voice might sound like. And so we just go around this very quickly, and I just want to kind of show you that these are images that have been with us since the 1920s. They carry through into the 1960s. These are all film stills from Chuck Norris movies of the 1980s. At the top, we have Team America, which skewers Bin Laden. At the bottom here, we have a Bugs Bunny cartoon, right? And then over here we have Aladdin. And again, what I want to stress here is that when we think about media and specifically popular culture, there is a very monolithic singular identity when it comes to representing what Muslims are. And within scholarship, there's a name for this, and it's called the 3B syndrome. It's a way in which scholars have looked at media very specifically, and mostly popular culture, films and television, to think about how Muslims have been represented and how Muslims and Arabic culture have been conflated to represent the enemy set against the West very specifically. And so the first syndrome is often it's called the billionaire, right? These are representing Muslims as sheiks or sultans, more commonly in our current kind of moment, often as oil tycoons. These wealthy individuals who are often behind the scenes financing terrorist organizations set against the West. And again, I just want you to see the date range here. So Valentino's films are in the 1920s, but then we have Lawrence of Arabia, right, which very famously puts a white person in the center of kind of this Arabian hero story. That's in the 1960s, but then in 2011, just a random film I came across, starring again Antonio Banderas as an Arabic Muslim, is all about kind of this control of wealth, that really this is not about religion, that religion is nothing more than a device for control of land, control of power, and that plays into a very common trope that we see kind of repeated today in our current contemporary milieu, in which you have political figures talking about Islam is not a religion, it's a political ideology, and that's directly inflected in these types of films. The second syndrome, right, in addition to billionaires, is that often women are represented as belly dancers. And so that very top image in 1897 is the very first motion picture film that Thomas Edison made called Fatima Dances. He could have picked anything to film, could have picked any representation, any identity, but he took a very kind of orientalized, eroticized body and turned that into an image that the West then could consume and make accessible to them. It made it something they could control. 1947 Slave Girl probably gives you a better idea of how Muslim women are often represented. They're often represented as courtesans or as members of harems, essentially prostitutes, bodies to be used by very evil, diabolical men who simply look at the woman's body as something to be dominated. And again, based solely on coincidence, I was watching, we had HBO, a random like free version last week, and I'm flicking through with my kids and we came across this film. And the exact moment that it was there is Jackie Chan walking into a harem, and all the women are dressed as belly dancers. That's a 2004 film. Now again, you could pick any representation, but you go to these very stock characters because they say something and speak about a dynamic that exists within the milieu. People know what this is, and it allows them to consume it in a much safer way. The syndrome that probably gets the most talk, the most analysis, but also one that we see show up most commonly in popular culture is bombers. Or another word simply for terrorists. And again, you can kind of see this. What I chose very specifically in the films that I wanted just to show you here were all films that predate 9/11, right? 9/11 exacerbates a new round of Islamophobia that really pushes it back. You can think about shows like 24, right, which essentially is nothing more than the demonization of Arabic culture and Muslims as the other. That comes after 9/11, and so we can think about a relationship between kind of the political milieu, what's happening in terms of how the United States is trying to deal with this greater cultural context and geopolitics, right? But these films tell us something else. They're kind of broadly within the West, again, when we're thinking about who should be the other, who is the one that we can represent as offsetting our values, and therefore that who we need to represent our values against, and that normally becomes stock caricatures of Muslims or Arabic people as simply terrorists. And so we can go back to 1977, which is Black Sunday, which if no one's ever seen is a film about a terrorist event coming to the Super Bowl, right? But then maybe most famously in the 80s, we have all the Chuck Norris movies, right? Chuck Norris, for whatever reason, often would simply place Arabic people or Muslims in random films that had nothing even to do with it, right? So a lot of his films, like Delta Force, are set the West versus the East. But in films that even didn't have that, you'd often just have a stock character put in there because it's a way to represent the monstrous other. And therefore, you make stronger a sense of what is the proper identity. The proper identity is liberal, the proper identity is Western, the proper identity is Christian, right? True Lies carries on with this trope. You even see it in a movie like Ernest in the Army, right? A stupid, silly comedy that's really supposed to just be something you consume for the enjoyment of it, centers this narrative on him joining the army to go fight against the evil Muslim other. And then in 1998, maybe one of the films that I personally find hardest to watch is The Siege, which represents kind of a political police state taken over, right, because there's a terrorist threat, and so the police come in, and they really show the effects of how politics can be played out on people's identities. Maybe, though, the best way to show you this is to pick a film that we would not necessarily expect to find these tropes played out most commonly, and that is in the classic Disney movie Aladdin.
Patient one.
You have it, then.
I had to slit a few throats, but I got it.
Stop, thief! I'll have your hands for a trophy, street rat!
You're my only friend, Abu.
Who always said Aladdin's hit the bottom? He's become a weapon, rising crime.
I blame parents, except he hasn't got 'em.
Gotta eat to live, gotta steal to eat. Tell you all about it when I got the time. One jump ahead of the slow pokes. One skip ahead of my doom. Next time, gonna use a nom de plume.
There he is! Heels from my cart.
Oh, I'm sorry, sir. I don't have any money.
Thief!
Yes, please. If you let me go to the palace, I can get some from the Sultan.
Do you know what the penalty is for stealing?
No! No, please!
Oh. Hey, looky here!
No friends got abracadabra. Let it rip! And then make the sucker disappear!
Jasmine will like this one.
And I'm pretty sure I'll like Princess Jasmine.
Your Highness, no. I must intercede on Jasmine's behalf. This boy is no different from the others. What makes him think he is what?
So just I spliced together some clips, but through this film, I mean, if you watch the whole film, it's rare to find a woman not represented as a type of belly dancer, right? The father is kind of this stereotypical chic, somebody who's so removed from the broader public, so much removed from his own community, so mired in his wealth, and he doesn't have to be concerned about anything. So if you know the film, he's simply playing with his little toys all the time, these little animals that he has, because he doesn't have to be concerned about the broader culture itself, right? So it's this representation that power kind of corrupts. And then we see, again, all this representation of violence. It's actually played out in the original lyrics to the opening song. Oh, I come from a land, from a faraway place where the caravan camels roam, where they cut off your ear if they don't like your face. It's barbaric, but hey, it's home. Right? After some deliberation, they do take out what's in green, but they keep it's barbaric, it's home. Right? And so again, what we see here is that who's going to be consuming a film like this? And so if we're giving this to 5, 6, 7-year-olds, and this might be their first experience coming across Arabic culture, maybe their first time coming across a religious identity that's different than theirs, what are they consuming? And what is being offered to them in terms of what does it mean, right, to practice Islam? What does it mean to come from a culture that is not your own? And we have these gross stereotypes and these gross misrepresentations that reduce these cultures and these religious peoples into just stereotypes that we can play off of. And so one of the ways that we can, one of the great kind of examples of this, if you want to kind of play this out a little bit, is that Jack Sheehan both does a documentary and then writes a book in 2014 called Real Bad Arabs. And notice if you can tell how real is spelled, R-E-E-L. So it's all about how specifically Arabic culture has been represented. And Sheehan is really concerned with how Arabic culture and Islam are really conflated together, that there is no difference between the two, that to be Arabic is to be Muslim is to be Arabic, and both are set squarely against Western culture. And so this is what he does. He surveyed more than 900 films, right, with appearances. It doesn't have to be centered on it, but just simply appearances of Arab-based characters. There are only a dozen were positive, 50 were balanced, and the rest were explicitly biased in some way. And so you can see his language. Arab stereotypes are deeply ingrained in American cinema. From 1896, so he's reflecting right here on Thomas Edison, filmmakers have collectively indicted all Arabs as public enemy number one. Brutal, heartless, uncivilized religious fanatics, and money, mad cultural others bent on terrorizing civilized Westerners, especially Christians and Jews. So again, just to show you those statistics, 900 films, 12 have positive representations, 50 are balanced. And balanced, if you watch the ones he say are balanced, you can make an argument always aren't that balanced, right? They're just not as explicit or as maybe demonizing as the films that are really explicit, but they're not positive by any meaningful way. And they're often thrown as just kind of trope characters to often have a level of comedy thrown into it, right? So they aren't positive, they aren't negative, but they're also very reduced, right? But the rest of the films, in some way, follow the 3B syndrome very specifically. This is especially true after 9/11, right? When one out of four films, not films specifically about anything to do with religion or Arabic culture, just one out of four films since 9/11 have some type of depiction that follows the 3B syndrome. And often it's just thrown in there as a type of stock character, or it becomes the force that the superhero is offset against, which is so important then to think about a superhero that's reframed in this way. All this then, what you can say is what happens, we can't say there's a direct correlation between the way a culture represents a religious identity or a cultural identity and how that culture and religious identity are then understood and allowed to empower themselves and have sovereignty and agency in our contemporary world. However, if you think that for 100 plus years, Arabic culture and Islam have been demonized to such an extent that they've been reduced. Giorgio Agamben is a political philosopher, and he talks about how within our contemporary moment that figures are often reduced to what's called bare life. That in order to gain power, we have to gain power over somebody. In order to do that, we often take identity markers and reduce them to the barest moment of life. Therefore, we can act upon them, and we don't have to be concerned. They don't have rights, they don't have privileges, because they no longer are a full human. They're simply the other that we're acting against. And with 100 plus years of this kind of existing within our cultural milieu, right, we do see a culture that in a very strong way has been Islamophobic, not simply since 9/11, but for a much longer period of time, right? And this is often a reactionary moment in which cultures look for somebody who's different, who's othered, in order to allow privilege to exist for a certain population. And so I just wanted you to kind of see what's happened, and this is kind of the post 9/11 moment, right? That what happens is we have representations in culture, we have a moment like 9/11, and now what we can say is, look, it all came true. These representations are directly indicated in this moment. And so now the 18 people who carried out that terrorist act are represented of 1.8 billion. And it's that problematic that comes out of media. Because if we're not represented and if we're not seeing different representations, we only see through one monolithic lens. And the result is that we don't have to be concerned, right, about people of difference, people who have different religious orientations or different cultural practices, because we've reduced them to being non-humans. Their religion isn't a viable religion, their culture isn't a viable culture, and therefore we don't have to give them space to be empowered. We don't have to give them space to be citizens. We can strip them of that right, right? And this isn't just indicative simply of religion. We can think about Japanese internment, right? There's various moments in our history in which we've reduced people to bare life. And the result of that is that we can then act upon them without consequence, without repercussions, because they don't have a voice to speak back. And so just a few statistics kind of pointed out. A 2011 Gallup poll, right, really emphasized the increase in Islamophobia, but the way they described it I thought was interesting. An exaggerated fear, hatred, and hostility toward Islam and Muslims that is perpetuated by negative stereotypes resulting in bias, discrimination, and marginalization, and exclusion of Muslims from social, political, and civic life. You could describe that as what happens in films. These are films that operate through negative stereotypes, that produce biases, that reduce and marginalize and then exclude people from the political sphere. They no longer have a voice to speak back. If they can't find a voice in popular culture, how can they find it within the public sphere? And how can they then find that empowerment to speak back against these gross misgeneralizations? A 2014 Pew poll, right, indicated that Muslims were the most disliked religious group in the United States, actually outranking atheists, who for the longest time had been the most maligned religious group in America. And then in a publication of the Journal of Applied Social Psychology, you notice a rise in hate crime since 2011, from 354 to 1,500 in the year essentially following 9/11. So maybe just to put it in bar graph for you to see it a little bit better, right? You see that in moments of heightened fear, heightened anxiety, cultures and nations often turn to somebody or something or some place that they can point to help ameliorate some of that anxiety and ameliorate some of that concern. And so after 9/11, we see an increase. But again, with the shifting over to from Obama's administration to the Trump administration that we're now in, we are seeing a rise in crime again. And it's often because of a rise in cultural anxiety has to find a place to expel that anxiety. And again, the most common way to do that is through popular culture because it's quote-unquote safe. But what we're seeing in our contemporary world is that safeness is translated into direct hate. Because if I don't see a person as a person, then when I come across them in the real sphere of living, the real embodied person, I just see a stock character. I see the stereotype that had existed in my mind because that's the only thing I have consumed. The result, right, or the response to this very commonly in America has been to try to situate religious identities or cultural identities that aren't considered traditionally American as American, right? So there's the great trope that America is a Christian nation. If we'd like to talk about that later, we can talk about how that's problematic, but also accurate to a certain extent. But what happens when we often come across these moments of how do we empower those who've been disenfranchised? How do we give a voice back? Well, the result has been not so much a celebration of their cultural identity or their religious identity, but really an emphasis on their American identity, right? We don't say often that we talk about American Christians. We simply say they're American. But we do make sure we say things like Muslim Americans, as if to indicate that their identity is not necessarily fully American, that they're also something different. So this is an ad produced by the Council of American Islamic Relations, very specifically after 9/11, in which there were obviously hate crimes perpetrated against Muslims, but also against Sikh populations that were often misrepresented and misunderstood to actually be Muslims. So they came out with this campaign called the We Are American campaign. And the whole point was to have ads, pictorial ads, images that represented Sikhs, Jains, Muslims, Hindus, anyone who culturally and religiously were not white Christians, to use images to show them kind of in an American setting. And so on the surface, right, and if you can kind of read here, it's a little small, so I'll read it for you. On my honor, I will strive to serve God and my country and to help people at all times, right? But if we look at the image closely, which is of a Girl Scout troop, what do we also notice is missing? If we take out the title, we're Americans and we're Muslims, how do we have any idea that they're Muslims? Right? Their religious identity has been effaced from this image. So while this is supposed to be a moment of trying to push back against these gross generalizations, the solution essentially is be American in the public sphere, be a good Girl Scout, keep your religion in your private sphere. That's the way that we can actually handle this problem, right? And so this was a popular ad. These ads were all over the United States for about a 5-year period until people started criticizing them for what they were lacking. And what they were lacking was, one, cultural difference, Again, not all Muslims have brown skin, right? There's no kind of emphasis on, let's say, Western or converts to Islam, right? There was no indication of who might be a Sikh or a Muslim. They're all placed together in a very kind of conflated way, again, in a generalized way. However, right, within the past few years, we've kind of seen the opposite. Rather than a way to speak back against Islamophobia is to erase one's religion, rather what we can do is actually show how the American experience is Muslim and the Muslim experience is American by showing these identity markers placed together. And I think Ms. Marvel, the comic that we will talk about here this evening, is really attempting to play with these same kind of tropes, right? Playing with these identity markers. Where do I belong? Who am I? Who makes these decisions for me? And artists, and these are all artists in the last 3 years, have decided to try to, again, use pictorial representations, to use popular culture, but to do so in a way that captures the nuance of one's identity as both religious and their cultural identity. And so here you see Muslim women doing iconic, let's say, Western activities, playing in a rock band. Right? Taqwa Core, just so we know, is an actual punk Muslim scene that really exists. Taqwa meaning pious, core, hardcore. So it's a music scene that takes their religion very hardcore, just like they take their music. And this is actually an all-female Taqwa Core band. This is Sadaf Syed herself. So you kind of see her wearing a hijab with it's an American flag. We see a boxer wearing a hijab. We see a woman doing makeup, right? We see basketball, and we see headphones. She has a whole series of these that are just massively interesting and in kind of how she, again, she's bringing together these cultural markers. In a similar way, just to show you another example, it's a little bit more artistic. Saba Chowdhury Barnard does kind of the same thing, but just more through paintings, right? She takes iconic images of women wearing the hijab, but then matches them up to the very kind of basic tropes of Americana, right? So we have the drinking the Diet Coke cans out of the hat. We have the Packers cheesehead hat. We have the Disney hat, right? We have the Groucho Marx mask. That one's Islamic identity does not make one not American, and one's American identity does not make one not Muslim anymore. That just like we talk about pluralism being something that creates space for all people, that's what they're attempting to do here. And they're attempting to show representations that overcome these gross generalizations that we see in Aladdin and we see in the films that we consume to say that we can represent differently because we can represent accurately. We can actually look at the people who live within our culture and see how they live out their existence as both Muslims and Americans simultaneously. They're not offset against each other as we often do see within popular culture. And so it's within this very specific light, right, that I would like us to engage with the emergence of Kamala Khan as Ms. Marvel, as an expression of popular culture that's used very specifically, from Willow Wilson's perspective, to expose the complexity and challenges of identity in America. We do so by engaging minority and underrepresented populations, but mostly also by seeing how they live out their daily lives. My favorite scene, to be honest, is the dinner table scene, and mostly the small moment in which you see the world's greatest dad cup. Right, this great juxtaposition of the brother praying and kind of ripping on his father's lifestyle, the mother ripping on the son, and there's the dad, the world's greatest dad, kind of this iconic gift that all kids give to their father at some point in America. It's such a great juxtaposition of what's happening in that moment. And so what we see is we get to see the daily lives of people who often aren't represented in this way. So rather than these gross generalizations that we get in film, we see a family, because that's what they are. They are a family. But we also get to see the consequences of othering, the othering that Kamala does to herself, the othering that's done to Kamala, let's say by Zoe when she talks about the hijab and the honor killing, right? Or when you smell like curry, so I need to get away from you. And also the realities of assimilation, right? Kamala's journey to me is a classic American tale of what does it mean to assimilate? To assimilate doesn't mean that I must get rid of part of my identity, or can I find a way to actually assimilate that identity into a new milieu, into a new cultural context? The comic isn't perfect in this way, but it's forcing us to reconcile how this is a classic American tale. American tale that allows us each to find space to have representations of ourselves as individuals, but also members of a nation and a community. Additionally, right, we can chart the role of popular culture and how this assumes a role in both vilifying identity markers, which we talked about, this is what I was hoping to show you up front, but also really as a way to expose the violence. And again, I read this comic, right, this piece of literature very specifically as one that looks at popular culture as a device, as a tool, not just as a piece of entertainment, but a very specific device that can speak back and reach a broader audience and allow in a nuanced way to see how lives are played out, right? The value of a comic is you can have so much different thing happen in paneling, right? You can have an image, you can have a dialogue, but then you can have sub-dialogue. And all that interplay forces you as a reader to think about how different characters represent different identity markers and how they're each struggling to be a person, right? Zoe walks in, if you read her shirt, and her shirt says, Bonita, 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 lovely, 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 right? She's trying to play this part, this kind of classic tale. And even Kamala says, right, she's so nice, because she's trying to think that that is the proper way. The proper way to be, the proper identity would be to be a tall, blonde woman who's confident and comfortable, like Carol Danvers, like the first Miss Marvel. But what she comes to see very quickly is that by assuming another's identity only produces more suffering. It only reproduces the type of gross generalizations that do exist because we're not willing to exercise our own identity. And then last, we can also outline, I'm sure I got cut off there a little bit then, we can outline how Kamala Khan reconciles the expectations of her family, right, of her secular friends, and of the nature of an individual calling, which she will come to see very specifically that her movement to action, her movement to recognize that her powers are not just powers, but powers to do good, are based on her familial culture and on her religion. She's not moved because she's obsessed with the Avengers. She's not moved to act because she's obsessed with Ms. Marvel. She's moved to act because the lessons she learns from her parents, that those who do good, who risk themselves, are blessed. There's the ayah that my father would tell me, right? You save one, you save them all. And so it's in these moments in which she's actually moved towards goodness, towards righteousness, towards action that's going to be compassionate and empathetic and to save lives, is not because she's a classic American superhero, it's because she's a Muslim. And it's because she's Pakistani. And she takes those cultural lessons and brings them into the American sphere. Right, and so just a little bit, in case you weren't able to fully read the comic, didn't have access to it, just a couple quick comments contextually, and then I'm going to say a little bit more, and then I'm going to be pretty much done for the discussion portion, right? Just so we know, it's created by Sana Amanat, author Willow Wilson, and artist Adrian Alfano, who won an award for the graphics for the first edition of Ms. Marvel. Kamala Khan is actually the fourth character to take the name of Ms. Marvel, so for those of you who are into comics, right, this is not the first rendition of Ms. Marvel, the most famous being Carol Danvers, who's actually represented in this comic a couple different times. So when Kamala's coming out of that vision, right, it is Ms. Marvel as Carol Danvers that speaks to her. Carol Danvers also shows up in a couple different ways. She also assumes the figure of Carol Danvers initially, right? That's the first character she wants to be, and then she realizes that simply taking that character is not going to be the means towards action. I'm not going to go down the route of the comic genealogy that leads us to Ms. Marvel. It is something we could talk about in individual groups, but just a quick backdrop, right? Like Ms. Captain Marvel, Ms. Marvel is actually imagined to be kind of a female counterpart to Captain Marvel, and she gains her power what's called Kree technology. Long story short, within the Marvel universe, right, and this is why comics are so brilliant, right, you often will have storylines about a single character, but those storylines then bleed into other storylines and other characters. So a quick rendition of this is there's a war between aliens, essentially. One of the groups, the Kree, decide to experiment on early Homo sapiens here on Earth. They kind of turn them into what are called inhumans. They have powers, they have abilities. With time, though, those inhumans become kind of genetically impure. And so there's an attempt to kill all them out, but the inhumans establish kind of a society of their own, kind of hidden beneath it. And these inhumans often become superheroes. The difference is a mutant, right, if you're familiar with that terminology, a mutant in, within the comic world is somebody who often gains these powers simply at the age of puberty. It's kind of within their genetic mold. An inhuman is one who has a legacy of these powers. They're latent within them, but they have to be activated by what is called the teragenesis. Right, so in the long kind of scope of all this, if you read the comic and you were confused when Kamala's simply walking and all of a sudden she's covered in fog, that fog is actually from a different storyline called the Infinity Wars, right? In which there's a battle going on between Inhumans and this guy Thanos. A Terrigen bomb is dropped on Earth to try to activate all these latent powers of these Inhumans to fight against Thanos. One of these people happens to be Kamala Khan, right? So we can talk about that in a little bit more detail. I think the most interesting part, though, is to choose to make her an Inhuman. Again, Willow Wilson, obviously they're playing off the Ms. Marvel, but they could have picked a new superhero. They could have simply invented another superhero. They could have chosen a different derivation, but they chose Ms. Marvel because Ms. Marvel, even as Carol Danvers, is an inhuman. And there's that small moment where she even says, right, she's reflecting, I feel different. I feel inhuman. And I think that plays, again, off the same tropes we began with, that often, again, Muslims are represented in an inhumane way. They're represented as non-humans. And I think this is kind of Willow Wilson's way of playing with that dynamic, right? What constitutes humanity? What constitutes humanness? What constitutes identity? She first appeared in actually the Captain Marvel number 14, so in August 2013. She's just in the backdrop of that one. She's not really doing anything, but if you look closely, she's right there. Kamala is a 16-year-old Pakistani-American from Jersey City who idolizes Carol Danvers. This is the other beautiful thing about comics. They're completely unabashed about kind of in bringing comic obsession into their own comics. So you often have people reading comics, but they're not reading about superheroes, fictional superheroes. They're reading comics about actual superheroes that exist within their world. And so she's a great example of this. She's, at the one moment, if you remember, she's typing on her computer, right? This is like a fan site in which you can write your own Marvel stories, right? So she's kind of writing this story about the Avengers and really thinking about the power of Ms. Marvel. She's given her own series, Ms. Marvel, on February 2014, becoming Marvel Comics' very first Muslim character to headline her own comic book. There are other characters that are Arabic or Muslim, but they're often either backdrop characters, sidekicks, or just simply kind of other characters put in. This is the first headlining character that's explicit in her religious identity. And I'm going to just show you a couple quotes, right? I'll read these kind of quickly, but I want you to kind of see the way in which the author and the editor were thinking about what they were attempting to do when they were constructing this comic. What was important to me and to editor Sana was to show that American Muslims are not monolithic, that there is no one stereotype that fits everybody, and that, like all families, not everybody in the same family believes the same thing or behaves in the same way, right? And I think the dinner scene shows that so perfectly, or when the mother, right, yells at the son for being a poor mullah, right, but then yells at the daughter for being a bad Pakistani girl, right? She's kind of attacking her culture and yet redeeming her culture simultaneously. And that you can get into argument about what's right, what's wrong, what's appropriate, what's not appropriate, but it's done with the same kind of love and oftentimes hilarity that happen in all families. And this is reflected in comments that you just can't see. This comment comes from Sana Amanat, the editor of it. As much as Islam is part of Kamala's identity, this book isn't preaching about religion or the Islamic faith in particular. It's about what happens when you struggle with labels imposed upon you and how that forms your sense of self. It's a struggle we've all faced in one form or another, and it isn't just particular to Kamala because she's Muslim, right? And it's this kind of sense of trying to understand the American experience as Muslim and the Muslim experience as American that I think this comic is trying to show us and illustrate as a means to push back against these gross generalizations. And so for me, and what I hope we can explore together today, is that her ability to change shape, this is her superpower. And one of the questions I have on here is, you know, what often makes one a superhero from a very generalized perspective is their power, right? But in this sense, she has the power to turn into anything. And the very first thing she does turn into is Carol Danvers. And she says it very explicitly. I don't want to just be the specific Miss Marvel Carol Danvers. I want to be a hyper-sexualized, politically incorrect version of that, right? Spandex and all. But what she comes to see is that in the end, changing her shape does not mean that she has to erase her ethnicity, her traditions, nor her religion. And what I'd like to propose to you, in fact, is that rather, her shape-shifting suggests that flexibility is a strength, that her ability to change, to have power, and to help those who are powerless, but also her ability to exist in different settings, to be Kamala in the mosque, right? To be Kamala the friend, to be Kamala the student, to be Kamala the daughter, and then to be Kamala the superhero. None of those reduce any of those identities, and none of those can reduce how we think about how people interact with others. And so, in this way, right, Kamala is a superhero exactly because she is both American and Muslim at once. Her power is to be many things, and to do so without changing herself. And so in this way, and I think I'm going to lose a little bit at this bottom, so I'll read it to you, right? Ms. Marvel is both a window into the American Muslim experience, right? She normalizes, and I'm putting it this way, she normalizes the American experience as Muslim and the Muslim experience as American. I actually think the first equation is more appropriate, that what this is not about trying to normalize Islam. It's attempting to normalize the American experience that can be Muslim. We often think, again, that it has to be a very specific type of identity marker, a very specific religious marker. But what this comic is showing us is that in this story, her very basic Pakistani Muslim identity is an American story. It's not being Americanized. She's actually extending and broadening how we think about the American project. And the other one that you can't see here is the other thing that I think this does in a very similar way is actually show a common device that we see within comics, then in the end, it's really not about the superhero's power, it's about their humanity, what they choose to do with that power, and how they choose to act it. And I see, we see that played out very explicitly, right? She even says it when she's talking about Zoe. She's glad that she lived. Even though she's been acted upon, even though she's been acted against, she recognizes that the greatest thing she could do there was to save the life of another and potentially risk her own in the process, right? And in this moment, it's not solely about her power. It's about that very sense of humanness, of humanity, of having empathy for the other and being brave enough and willing enough to act. So just two things I want to show you here, because I just found this fascinating as I was putting this kind of lecture together, right? One of my favorite moments, this is the moment when she's thinking, do I help Zoe? Who is going to? Is it me or somebody else? And so there's this ayah, verse from the Quran. Then my dad always quotes when he sees something bad on TV, a fire or a flood or a bombing, whoever kills one person is as if he has killed all of mankind, and whoever saves one person is as if he has saved all of mankind. Again, in this moment, when she sees somebody who's at the precipice of death, she is not moved to act because she's trying to model Miss Marvel. And she's not moved to act because she sees herself as a superhero. She's moved to act by citing from the Quran. And I think it's in that moment that this is where Willow Wilson is speaking back against Islamophobia and speaking back against these gross representations. Then we actually go into the religious structure. What we do see is something much different than the way that jihad and Quran and Islam itself have been represented, right? We see how it can be a force directly to do good. And to show you play this out in a very real sense, and I just have to remember the name of the group that put this together, the Freedom Defense Initiative bought 50 bus ads in San Francisco this past year, very specifically that were Islamophobic. And you can kind of see them here, often very specifically connecting Islam to Nazism. And so you can just see how these images are. Islamic Jew hatred, it's in the Quran. 2/3 of all U.S. aid goes to Islamic countries, stop the hate. Islamic Jew hatred again, and here you see a Muslim and Hitler. Here you see reloading fire again, that is his jihad, what's yours? Again, if this is the only way that you've ever come across the word jihad, and the only maybe other way you've ever seen that term used is in a film or in a TV show like 24, now you think jihad is violence directed against non-Muslims. Jihad simply means to struggle in the way of. But we wouldn't know that from these representations. But the beautiful thing here is that cultural jammers decided that Miss Marvel, based on what they read in this very specific comic, could be a tool to fight back against this. So what they started doing was going around and putting Miss Marvel images directly over these ads. So here you see her busting through Stop Racism. Here you see her busting through Free Speech Isn't a License to Spread Hate. Over here, Islamophobia Hurts All of Us, Stop the Hate. And then calling all bigotry busters, Stop the Hate. A call to action. Each one of you can be a superhero. Each one of you can make this movement to push back against these representations. It doesn't require power. It doesn't require superpower. It requires a sense of bravery and maybe a willingness to take suffering on yourself to push back against those who suffer more because they don't have a voice, right? And so with that, I pulled up these images because they do kind of relate to some of the discussion questions that I'm proposing to you all. I hope that you'll see that the discussion questions are really kind of directly in line with how this presentation played itself out. I'm hoping that within the discussion groups, we can reflect a little bit more specifically on moments within Miss Marvel that help us see how it's playing with issues of identity, of culture, and of religious difference.
So we're going to break into our discussion groups now. There's one here, and then one out in the hall around the corner, and that one is quieter than the one that's out around the corner, so please.
Hello? Hello? All right, we're going to bring it back together really quick for kind of a final discussion together. So there's some mics over here, but it's also not a huge room, so if you can project. But we're just wondering if anyone has any maybe specific questions that came out of the group that they'd like to ask, or maybe something that in your group that you discussed that you thought was significant or insightful that maybe you'd like to share with the other groups.
Oh, it's just, are there any other comics that have looked at Muslim or Islamic issues? I know Sandman, there's a
at most passing reference, or without explicitly saying it, enemies carrying stock kind of caricatures often of Arabic culture, Muslims, right? Not explicitly said, but sometimes in the backdrop of these.
Like ninjas for Asian.
There you go. Yep, very, very similar. But there's nothing else that takes it on in this kind of explicit way. Okay. Good, yes.
One of the points that came out in our discussion was that, you know, if we're looking at Ms. Marvel, this Ms. Marvel comic, it is in many ways more advanced, more progressive than what we find in cinema. And, you know, in pop culture in general, there are some positive, you know, you do find positive images of Muslims here and there. In fact, we just received the Justice catalog for our daughters, and there's a woman, a little girl wearing hijab in the catalog. That's, I'm surprised, because growing up, that you never saw stuff like that. But anyway, so there are things that are progressive in pop culture, but if we're comparing this to cinema, this is clearly ahead of the curve.
Yeah, I think there's not, I mean, cinema is still really problematic, and just often just throwing in trope devices, right? And even just, often for quick comedic relief, right? Which is often maybe just as problematic as really demonizing them as terrorists, is reducing them to something we simply laugh at. And if you're familiar with like Halal in the Family, right? There are comedians who are attempting in a very specific way to push back against that, but it takes place on YouTube channels or very small moments because it's maybe not consumable for all audiences yet. Yeah.
What do you think about the series
I think in the same way that there's A Little Mosque on the Prairie, it's a television show, right? And there's also All American Muslim, and there was one other, I'm trying to think now of the television show.
That's produced in Canada.
Yeah, right. I think it is a different perspective, Little Mosque on the Prairie from a Canadian perspective, and All American Muslim, which was a TLC show. I feel that the TLC show was very much a voyeuristic perspective on Arabic culture and Muslims, where Little House, I mean, that was really attempting to show, again, I think somewhat similar to this, kind of the daily experiences of what one experiences growing up in a culture that may not have always had space for your religious identity. I just, sometimes these documentary type shows, though, reduce into types of conflicts that are going to produce viewership. And so that's what I think happens with some of these shows very specifically. I think their intentions are correct. I think what they're trying to do is similar to what this comic is doing, is to expose bigotry, to expose misrepresentations, but they're also television shows out for ratings. And if you watch them all the way through, they often kind of will add storylines in that don't seem that significant and end up reducing maybe the broader claims they're making about representations and identity to conflicts between characters that, if we're not careful, we can then reduce to say it's a conflict because they're Muslim or they're a conflict because they're Arabic.
But in some ways, it's the sort of, de-exoticizing.
Yeah.
Like, this is no different than the ethical worldview that has shaped superheroes since the 20s, and yet here's this one, and particularly a Muslim sort of iteration.
No, I think that's a beautiful point, because I think there is something very specific, again, by trying to show that her identity as a Pakistani-American Muslim is the American experience, right? And that her desire to do good is not connected because there's this American trope that superheroes are superheroes because they adopt American liberal values. But no, it's kind of a universal principle of help, of love, of aid. And so there's a couple moments, right, when the Avengers come down when she's in the midst and she says, you speak my language, and we speak the language of all faiths, right? And then there's this moment, she turns the ayah, but then there's the other beautiful moment that she says, those who choose to act are the ones who are blessed, right? And then the conversation with her father, right? Why did you name me this name? A very exotic name, and people pointed out to me. No, it's because it means perfection, right? And this and tells a story, but then says you are perfect the way you are. And so for me, it's these moments of kind of familial either conversations or her reflecting very specifically on some aspect of her religious identity that shows, again, that that's where this source of inspiration comes from. And I think that's directly supposed to be, I don't disagree, I think it is slotted in to a certain extent, so that when somebody's thinking about the tropes that I kind of showed at the beginning of this, that thinks that Islam equals violence because jihad equals violence against the West, this is directly saying, like, no, see what comes out of our faith is this superhero capacity to do good. Yeah.
I would like to say that nice, these comic things, but behind this comic, there's also, we have to be careful, we're preaching a philosophy and religion. Whether this comic is about Christianity, it's preaching actually inducted in Christianity, and it's about Islam, inducted in Christianity. And when you, for example, when you refer to that verses in Quran, definitely to one person that killed the entire humanity. But we are not talking about other verses. After that, it says something totally opposite to that. And so we have to be careful what we preach. I mean, we have to separate also the comic in the situation now, with the situation with Muslim and that. I'm a Muslim myself, so I know the situation. But we have to be careful what we also preach.
I get what you're saying. I don't think that the comic, though, and I think that the author and the editor are very specific, that this is not supposed to be preaching about what Islam is. It's supposed to be representing that this is an example of an American experience that's also one that's Islamic. And therefore, when we think about Islam, we have to think in a much more expansive way, that there's not a expression point, and there's not one moment we can go into the Quran and pull it out. I agree with you that if we simply pull that out, right, we've reduced the religion now to just that moment. But in the same way that we've reduced Islam and Muslims to this kind of monstrous other through popular culture, this is an attempt by popular culture to actually rescue, right, some of the religious actual foundations. Right, there's a sacred foundation for this, I think, to your point, that is not supposed to be about preaching that this is what Islam is absolutely, or this is what Islam is for all people in all places, but that this is what it is for her, Kamala.
We also have ready to reject those negative points, whether it's in Islam, Christianity, or any other religion, for the sake of humanity. Like, for example, when you tell these to these people, they don't know, what is the verses right after that? That is verses number 32. And if you go to 33 and 34, 33 and 34 is actually saying something that should not be preached anywhere in the world. Today, anywhere in the world, even in the ancient time. 33 is saying actually, sorry to add. So that's, I think that's the misconception they are telling us about this religion. As I say, I'm a Muslim, I was a Muslim, and I see the negative images that they're trying to create. That's not because most of the Muslims are good people, they try today, everyday life, and they are no different than any other people around the world. But the doctrine of Islam is something different. As I say, number 33 is actually saying how to, I don't want to get too much deep, but.
But I mean, I guess the point I would only make, right, because we don't have necessarily the time to debate the Quran, is that we also can't do that, though. We can't point just to another verse and say that that offsets this moment and speaks to something different. I think when we think about religion, specifically religious texts, we have to think about them in their wholeness. We have to think about their hypocrisies and points of contradiction. We have to be willing to speak back at how these works are also placed in certain contexts and specific historical moments. And so all that does speak that it is difficult to simply take a verse out. And that's why I agreed with you that there is a slotting in. But I want to stress that this is not an attempt to whitewash Islam into just one identity again. It's really a trying to push back against the way that it had been reduced and recognizing that it can be inflected in different ways. And that it's a group. Right, and I think that kind of speaks to the other question here, right? That there's a way in which these are understood to kind of be similar motivation factors.
Right. Well, I'll just point out, I mean, there is, of course, a range of interpretations in Islam. So verse 33, for example, is a range of interpretations of that verse. Here, I think I can see this is very realistic because I can see the average Muslim, they're not scholars of the Quran. They don't know every verse, but I've heard many Muslims use that exact line. So I think I find it very realistic as like somebody who's not a scholar of Islam expressing her religious beliefs.
And I think it's also important that it comes from her father, right? That it's that when her father would see something horrible on TV, that this is what he would say as a way to kind of attempt to understand it. So I think it's also trying to illustrate, again, how certain traditions, certain religious aspects, certain cultural aspects are assimilated into the daily reality, right? She recalls it in this moment. I think she could have recalled any motto, but she recalls that one. And is it significance comes from the Quran? I want to argue that there is significance there, but I also think it's more significant that it comes from her father. right? That a lot of this is that familial angst. Where does she fit in, right? And it's always her parents, though, that seem to be kind of this motivating force behind her. My parents say those who are blessed are the ones who act. My father was, and she didn't recall it, to your point. I'm not the scholar myself. My father reminded me, and it places me kind of within the sense of humanness, of humanity with others.
Right, like there's whole storylines around their aloneness, and you know, like you have the entire trope of like they're an important member of someone's family dying as the motivation to have them go off and do whatever they need to go do. Meanwhile, Kamala has like a really very rich network or family,
close friends.
Several close friends. You know, you have a sense too of like, you know, even people. Some of the people in her school who are like Zoe here, who's sort of annoying. But like, who has sort of her moments of humanity? Of like, oh, I had a brush with death, and I suddenly am like a more thoughtful person.
Right.
And so she's much more embedded in a community that really cares about her.
Right.
In a way that a lot of superheroes who are very like brooding, alone, you know, sort of personality to the world.
Now, I like that idea too, right? Because there is a sense that oftentimes within comics, there's that mode a family member dies, or I need to revenge that moment, and then it turns into the superhero trope. She wants to go to a party. So she just leaves, right? She wants to be part of that bigger community. She wants to explore her different identity markers that she does have. And it's in that exploration of friendship, socialization, that she gains something true about herself. I think the realization is, I don't need to be there to have an identity. And that's then inflected in the type of shape-shifting. So what I want, though, is I want to be beautiful and powerful. And as soon as she's Carol Danvers, well, that's done nothing. It's not solved that kind of internal angst, right? So the image that we see is really, I think, the internal struggle she's going through until she can say, right, I tell them who I am. I am Miss Marvel as Kamala Khan, not as somebody else.
So it's funny that you mentioned the community embeddedness, because a lot of things with comics is their characters, when they move between different models, you lose some of that character. What was fascinating with that is when Mark Waid started writing her as part of the Avengers, like when it was the much younger set of Avengers, he very much kept that element of she met one of the other characters fighting in her neighborhood, and he knocked over this giant monster on top of one of the stores in her neighborhood, and she flipped out. And he was like, don't worry, I totally got this. And he didn't understand why it mattered to her. And he wrote the tone of her community still mattered to her, that having a superhero battle in her community was not cool, because she knew the store owner. And he's like, are you going to help him clean this up because you just destroyed his storefront? And the kid's like, because he's like a kid here, he's like, no, why would I? It's part of being a superhero. So Mark Waid kept that voice and some piece of that voice, which is not a common thing in comics. Usually you don't keep that continuity of character.
Right.
So that was also something unique to see, that even though I haven't read the source material here, some authors are keeping pieces of that character quite alive and quite true to what's envisioned in the sole title. That's very unique to me to hear that's translated.
Absolutely. Yeah.
Now, other adaptations of Kamala, like she's in, there's a Marvel iPhone game called Avengers Academy, and like it's like all the superheroes, but in college. so like all the other superheroes, like Tony's like himself, he's like, I'm gonna go hit on and, like swing in the hot tub, and she's also herself. She's like, I don't think I want to go out and fight bad guys right now because my parents want me.
Yeah, her humanness is never lost in the fact that she gains these superhero powers. In fact, maybe her humanness becomes more accessible to us, right, as she struggles to understand what she can do, what she can't do, and what she's supposed to do.
Thank you, everyone.
Thank you all for coming out.